The terrorist attacks in Paris cast a dark cloud over Saturday night's second Democratic debate. This hour, how the candidates did when faced with a sudden foreign policy crisis. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Saturday, the three Democratic presidential candidates on stage in Des Moines engaged in tense and at times heated exchanges over foreign policy, gun control, and Wall Street. In the first half hour, we'll talk with one of the debate moderators, Kathy Obradovich of the Des Moines Register, also Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters. Then in the second half hour, Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University, also presidential debate historian Alan Schroeder, joins us. That's all coming up. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we want to focus on the second Democratic debate, which took place on Saturday night. Later in the hour, we're going to talk with Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University, primarily about the impact such debates can have on public opinion. Also, presidential debate historian Alan Schroeder joins us. But first of all, let's talk with a person who was there, actually on stage, Kathy Obradovich, one of the debate's moderators, political columnist for the Des Moines Register, the Register, one of the sponsors of Saturday night's debate. Kathy, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Clay Masters with us as well, Morning Edition host, and also on the track covering our political candidates as they crisscross Iowa. Hi, Clay.
Hey, Ben.
Well, the terrorist attacks in Paris cast a dark shadow, no doubt, over Saturday night's second Democratic debate. Still, the three presidential candidates on stage, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley, engaged in tense and at times heated exchanges. Foreign policy front and center there at the beginning, gun control, Wall Street, some of the other issues that were discussed. And we want to reach out to our listeners to ask you what you saw in that debate, what jumped out at you. Do you feel the presidential debates have served you well in sizing up the candidates? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Kathy, I want to go to you first of all. We've had a lot of coverage on NPR about this debate already, but what is missing is for you to give us a behind-the-scenes glimpse at how Friday's attack, 24 hours, more or less, before the debate, changed the focus of the debate. What was going on leading up to the debate?
Yeah, it was really interesting. We were actually at Drake on set for our very first on-set rehearsal before the debate, all sitting there in street clothes. We had a CBS intern standing in for the candidates, John Dickerson, working through camera shots, and we all had fake questions in front of us. When we hear over our earpiece that there's been what looks like a terror attack in Paris, and nothing more was really said about it. We all started checking our phones, looking for news about it. And news at that point was pretty sparse. We didn't know that it was necessarily coordinated attacks, et cetera. A lot we didn't know. So I had some place to rush off to. I left, circled back with CBS News later in the afternoon. By that time, I realized that this had been a major, major deal. They were in the process of ripping up the entire debate script and refocusing it on national security, terrorism, foreign policy. So I actually went to bed Thursday night not knowing for sure whether I was really going to still be in the debate, you know, if they were going to totally. Yeah, I mean, you know.
Might toss you out.
Nobody said anything, but, it's possible they could totally change the format. You know, we'd been doing weeks of work, you know, on questions and topics and stuff like that. And, it looked like it could be just all thrown out. But then by Friday morning, I didn't know what the script was going to look like, but I did know we were still on and that we were still probably going to be handling roughly the same topics that we were talking about before. And we went on from there. But this was a very, every part of it was happening sort of at the last minute. Kevin Cooney, who was a co-panelist with me from KCCI TV, we didn't actually see a complete script until 1 hour before airtime.
Well, congratulations. I think I'm looking on the internet too. My own view, and I think views of a lot on the internet. Bravo! You did a marvelous job, and you certainly didn't reflect any of the the tension or last minute changes.
Well, CBS News and John Dickerson were amazing. John Dickerson in particular, what a professional. And, you know, if I was trying to follow along with his first segment of questions on my script, it was not there because he was really working in the moment. It was really amazing to watch.
Before we get to a little bit of the debate analysis, Clay Masters, you've been covering these candidates across the state in a variety of settings. What was the mood contrasted with what you get as a stump speech in a town hall or something? Contrast that with the mood you found there in the audience.
Well, leading up to the debate, I got there fairly early, a few hours ahead of time, not as early as some reporters were, but I did kind of a walk around Drake. And I've covered a lot of these multi-candidate events. On the Democratic side, they're really known for bringing out supporters and riling up people on the street and cheering and chants. And by, I think it was about 3 o'clock when I got to the campus of Drake University and did a circle around campus, and it was pretty quiet. There were definitely supporters out, but it was a much more, you know, sobering time than, say, the JJ dinner, which was held in Des Moines a couple weekends ago, or the Hall of Fame dinner that was held back in the summer. So it was a much quieter scene when I got there. Certainly as it got closer to debate time, some of former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley's folks were out there cheering as people were walking into the debate hall. There were watch parties for both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders as well as Martin O'Malley. So people were out. They were there to support their candidate, but it was definitely an impact was felt by the recent attacks in Paris.
Clay Masters with us, as well as Kathy Obradovich's first half hour. Doing some analysis now. Now, Hillary Clinton, the leader, according to the polls, in the three remaining Democratic candidates for the presidential nomination. She wasted no time, the former Secretary of State in the Obama administration, contrasting her former boss when asked about confronting the Islamic State. Here's a question asked by CBS News political director John Dickerson.
So, Secretary Clinton, I'd like to start with you. Hours before the attacks, President Obama said, "I don't think ISIS is gaining strength." 72% of Americans think the fight against ISIS is going badly. Won't the legacy of this administration, which you were a part of, won't that legacy be that it underestimated the threat from ISIS?
Well, John, I think that we have to look at ISIS as the leading threat of an international terror network. It cannot be contained. It must be defeated. There is no question in my mind that if we summon our resources, both our leadership resources and all of the tools at our disposal, not just military force, which should be used as a last resort, but our diplomacy, our development aid, law enforcement, sharing of intelligence in a much more open and cooperative way, that we can bring people together. But it cannot be an American fight.
Okay. Also, ISIS cannot be contained. It must be defeated. Kathy Obradovich, there she is separating, putting some distance between her and the president. I wonder, she has the foreign policy credentials here, but given that she was part of the administration, is this a plus or a minus for her?
Well, it's a minus for her in the sense that the Obama administration, going into this latest Paris attack, didn't look like it knew what was going on. And, you know, obviously that reflects on her as former Secretary of State. I thought she handled the question fairly well in the debate. Her foreign policy experience obviously gave her an advantage when, you know, the heightened focus on terrorism became the focus of the debate. But I thought she looked better mostly by comparison to Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley, who I didn't think either one of them did very well at all in handling the foreign policy issues beyond just going back again to attack Hillary Clinton on her vote in favor of the Iraq war and you know, trying to make the link that set the stage for what's going on right now with ISIS.
And as a matter of fact, reading reports here, Kathy, perhaps being part of this event, you would know more about this. But evidently, Bernie Sanders' staff wrangling with the debate sponsors to keep his 90-second general opening statement from being replaced by each candidate's comments on the attacks. And
yeah, I wasn't privy to any of that discussion. I certainly read all the reports. It wouldn't surprise me if Bernie Sanders wanted to keep the focus on domestic policy. That's definitely where his wheelhouse is. And you saw in the debate, he used most of his 90 seconds or whatever that opening statement was to make condolences about Paris, make a statement about Paris, and then go straight to we need to work on domestic economic security.
Mm-hmm. Clay, I want to ask you, did you see any shifts between what the candidates said on Saturday night and what you've been following on the campaign trail?
Well, definitely when you think about the Jefferson Jackson dinner, which was the last time there was a multi-candidate event among the Democrats, Bernie Sanders was attacking Hillary Clinton, but he wasn't really saying her name. I mean, it was a much more direct attack than what we've seen before. Another thing to keep in mind, too, we talked about it when we were discussing Kathy's role as a moderator. This was a very different debate than anything we've seen so far. Take in contrast the first Democratic debate. I mean, when you think about that first debate, you think of Jim Webb wanted more time. Lincoln Chafee was having kind of an awkward day. And Bernie Sanders was sick of hearing about Hillary Clinton's damn emails.
And he still is.
And he's still sick of hearing about it. So then when you contrast the debate to a lot of the Republican debates, a debate is usually between two people. And when you have that many people on stage during these Republican debates, it makes it hard to even have a debate because everybody's trying to elbow theirself into the conversation. So it wasn't that you heard a whole lot of different, especially, another thing that I noted was after a half hour into that debate, I'm using air quotes right now, the debate, there was no applause. There weren't any of the applause lines. It felt like a debate where there was a conversation happening.
Right. And sometimes these events, there are directions to not give applause, but there were no directions as to no applause here, Clay?
Not that I heard.
No. I think that audience was free to applaud to things that candidates said. The only time they were asked not to applaud, I think, was right at the very beginning. John Dickerson gave a little opening and there was a moment of silence. And, they mm-hmm. didn't want a lot of applause during that part of the show.
And really, after those 30 – I think it was about 30 minutes that foreign policy was discussed in light of the Paris attacks – it was almost like we now begin our regularly scheduled debate. It really did shift to a lot of the things, the kitchen table issues you expected to hear from a Democratic debate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you didn't want to just completely throw out all of the discussion that people expected from candidates about the issues that they have been talking about most on the campaign trail. And certainly those are the issues, minimum wage, jobs, health care, all those things candidates really have been talking about it. And there were questions that needed to be answered. And I also think that there were some differences between the candidates that we wanted to explore. And you just didn't want to give up that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the foreign policy focus here, it was interesting. And also to contrast that with the Republican candidates for president. This discussion, I believe early on, Kathy, to discuss this war, whether the U.S. is at war with, quote, radical Islam, jihadists, radical Islamists. What difference does that make? Because that really separates – I don't know about the three on the stage, but this party from the Republican Party, doesn't it?
I've asked that same question to some of the Republican presidential candidates. What difference does it make what
right.
you call it? And it is, I think, in some ways a semantic discussion. It's also, I think, a matter of attitude. A lot of the candidates who are hitting hard on wanting to make sure that – everyone knows that we're fighting radical Islam, are trying to appeal to the Christian conservative bloc in Iowa. And so that is part of, I think, this sort of religious war is part of, how they're framing this struggle. Also, they're arguing that Obama is being ineffective in fighting this because he's too politically correct to call it what they consider it is. And so all the Democrats on stage agreed essentially that what they would need to do is fight terrorism and not bring in some sort of overall religious battle. But this is something that this discussion that we had on Saturday night, we're going to hear more in the general election because Republicans are going to keep hammering them on that. Mm-hmm.
And, and another thing that a lot of times gets said by Republicans, especially I think of Mike Huckabee, regularly talks about President Obama says that the biggest threat that we face as a nation is climate change. And he says, you know, things like I take the terrorism to be a bigger threat than a sunburn. You had Sanders asked about, do you still feel that climate change is the number, you know, Sanders also thinks that that's a big problem. And this is something you're starting to hear more. Martin O'Malley said it, but Bernie Sanders said climate change is directly related to the growth of terrorism because as countries fight over water and resources, they become more desperate and, resort to violence. So that's another thing that I kind of noted in the debate is that we were talking about terrorism. Climate change was suddenly a part of the discussion.
Yeah, and immigration also. Right. The context of perhaps terrorists coming over our lax borders. And, interestingly, the Democratic candidates would not let go of the idea that a comprehensive reform has to be done along with significant upgrades to border security, that they're not willing to let go of that sort of quid pro quo or a legislative bargaining chip.
Mm-hmm. One of the standout moments of the evening that received a lot of applause was related to immigration. Here's former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley lagging in the polls, we have to say, in the single digits. But here was his standout comment from Saturday night.
The fact of the matter is, and let's say it in our debate because you'll never hear this from that immigrant-bashing carnival barker, Donald Trump. The truth of the matter is, net immigration from Mexico last year was zero. Fact check me. Go ahead, check it out. But the truth of the matter is, if we want wages to go up, we've got to get 11 million of our neighbors out of the off-the-book shadow economy and into the full light of an American economy.
Okay. So this is really one of the ways in which the Paris attacks is going to turn some of these discussions on their head. Do you think, Clay Masters, we're going to have also here in Iowa a discussion about refugees? I know that's being talked about. We're covering it on Iowa Public Radio. What is a safe way to welcome in people in need?
Yeah, you're seeing Republican presidential candidates. You know, they didn't have a debate, but we're seeing them, of course, comment on the Sunday shows as well as on Twitter about what should be done about refugees coming. And Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, has said, you know, let's stop bringing in refugees. Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, has said we can still accept refugees, but they need to be Christians. You know, so there is a discussion that has really put the discussion into overdrive, it seems, since the Paris attacks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do think that Iowa has a tradition of accepting refugees. Going back to the 1970s, Robert Ray accepting the Southeast Asian boat people. And so, you know, this is a discussion that absolutely could be relevant to Iowa, as well as the larger issues of immigration, where, you know, we have a reliance for agricultural and meatpacking on that labor.
Kathy Obradovich with us, along with Clay Masters. Kathy Obradovich of the Des Moines Register, one of the Saturday night's debate moderators. Let's listen to a little bit of you in action, Kathy, because because I empathize with you here, that politicians, of course, want to stay on their political message. We journalists want them to answer the question. And here's one of these. You can kind of judge it. It's kind of a long thing, an exchange you had with Bernie Sanders about his call for a national minimum wage. You have to ask a follow-up because he's not really answering what you wanted to have answered. Let's listen.
Senator Sanders, you've actually talked about immigration as being a wage issue in the United States, and I want to actually go directly to the wage issue now. You've called for raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour everywhere in the country. But the president's former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, Alan Krueger, has said a national increase of $15 could lead to undesirable and unintended consequences of job loss. What level of job loss would you consider unacceptable?
Kathy, let me say this. No public policy doesn't have, in some cases, negative consequences. But at the end of the day, what you have right now Millions of Americans work in two or three jobs because the wages that they are earning are just too low. Real inflation accounted for wages has declined precipitously over the years. So I believe that, in fact, this country needs to move toward a living wage. It is not a radical idea to say that if somebody works 40 hours a week, that person should not be living in poverty. It is not a radical idea to say that a single mom should be earning enough money to take care of her kids. So I believe that over the next few years, not tomorrow, but over the next few years, we have got to move the minimum wage to a living wage, $15 an hour, and I apologize to nobody for that.
You said there are consequences. You said there are consequences for any policy. Do you think job losses are a consequence?
This is what I think. Accepting? This is what many economists believe. But one of the reasons that real unemployment in this country is 10%, one of the reasons that African-American youth unemployment and underemployment is 51%, is the average worker in America doesn't have any disposable income. You have no disposable income when you're making $10-$12 an hour. When we put money into the hands of working people, they're going to go out buy goods, they're going to go out buy services, and they are going to create jobs in doing that. That is the kind of economy I believe. Put money in the hands of working people. Raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Okay. Kathy Obradovich in discussion there with Bernie Sanders on stage at the debate, the second Democratic debate there. Kathy, comment on that and trying to nail down politicians or on this exchange or any others is a tough chore.
It is tough in any debate because everything you do is a balancing act.
Yeah.
Because I asked Bernie Sanders a follow-up, because other candidates weighed in on the minimum wage issue, we had to scrap two other questions that, you know, we were prepared to ask on broader ways to raise wages and also on trade, which is important to Iowa. So, you know, everything you do, you're sacrificing something. And, you know, I wanted to bring back to Bernie Sanders just, you know, how many jobs are you willing to lose in pursuit of perhaps what might be greater economic benefits overall by having a higher minimum wage in America. But there's only so much you can do, and there's only so much time you have, and eventually you do have to move on.
Right, and we have to move on here in just a moment. Of course, we didn't even discuss some of the issues that we're talking about, both Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley ripping into Hillary Clinton over the support she enjoys from Wall Street donors. Also, gun control discussed. We didn't get to that, but let me ask each of you before we say goodbye here, your takeaway from this debate, Kathy Obradovich?
Well, first of all, I think that it is ushering in a new phase of this campaign where, in fact, the candidates are going to be more sharply critical of each other than they were up into this debate. We saw Bernie Sanders, like Clay said, you know, sick and tired of your damn emails, and he still is. But he was perfectly willing to go after her in pretty tough terms on her campaign contributions and how it affects her relationship with Wall Street and how credible she is on those issues. So I think that we will see that going forward. The candidates didn't go over the line. There's always a risk in going negative. And so that's going to embolden them to go forward.
Clay, 30 seconds for you if you had some final thoughts.
Well, the gloves are off now, it seems. They're calling each other by name and they have the attacks down. You're even seeing it yesterday as the candidates hung around on Sunday, still trying to get those Iowa caucus votes before the caucuses on February 1st.
Right.
And they're less than 3 months. I don't know if you know that, Ben.
I think it's been drilled into me sufficiently. Clay Masters, look forward to your reporting and your interviews on Morning Edition as we continue through this political season before the Iowa caucuses. Kathy Obradovich, thank you very much. One of the debate's moderators, political columnist for the Des Moines Register. Thank you for coming into our studio, Kathy.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University will talk about the impact such debates can have on public opinion. And then we get a presidential debate historian to join us and talk about what a difference debates can make. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer talking about couple things having to do with the second Democratic debate Saturday night that took place at Drake University in Des Moines. I want to continue that in a slightly different perspective here. Perhaps you watched, perhaps you'd like to weigh in, perhaps you'd like to talk about presidential debates. Have they served you well in this political season in sizing up the candidates? What do you especially like or dislike about presidential debates? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Joining us this half hour, Kelly Winfrey, assistant professor at Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism, also coordinator of research and outreach at the Katz Center for Women in Politics, also at ISU in our Ames studio. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Ben.
Great to have you with us. Also with us, Alan Schroeder, professor of journalism at Northeastern University. That's in Boston, presidential debate historian and working on his third edition of the book Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, that third edition coming out next year. Alan Schroeder, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Kelly Winfrey, let me start out with you. I want to throw you this clip from the debate. This is of particular interest to you as someone who works at the Katz Center for Women in Politics. Not so subtle, perhaps subtle, reference that Hillary Clinton made to the presidency in her closing statement.
I think the president's job is to do everything possible, everything that she can do to lift up the people of this country, starting with our children and moving forward.
Okay, you heard the murmur in the audience before the applause. Kelly Winfrey, she is in this, in contrast to 2008, making it different in terms of pointing out she would be historic.
Yeah, she certainly is. And I think that it's a difficult balance for her. She really shied away from talking about her gender and the unique kind of historic moment it would be if she were elected in 2008. But this time around, it's much more foregrounded, but I would say in a good way. I think it's important as far as rallying women voters to support her, as well as just to note that she is different than any other president we've had before. Mm-hmm. And I think that those kind of subtle linguistic choices are good ideas for her.
Mm-hmm. And also earlier in the debate, we heard when she was attacked about the donations, perhaps Wall mm-hmm. Street donations, she came back with saying that her donors were 60% female?
Yeah, she said 60% female, which I think she's particularly proud of. A little bit earlier in the cycle, she was having a little bit of trouble gaining support, particularly among white women. Mm-hmm. And that support has risen over the past month or two. So I think that she's very proud of that fact. And it also kind of, your hope is the bandwagon effect, right? That other women will say, oh, well, women are supporting her, so I should too.
Mm-hmm. Kelly Winfrey, what else jumped out at you in terms of, well, also public opinion here? What did you see happening in the second debate?
Well, in a primary debate, I would argue primary debates are kind of the most important debates because there are far few differences among the candidates because they're all part of the same political party. And I think that both Clinton and Sanders did a good job distinguishing themselves on what issues are important to them and where their area of expertise is. Sanders was very much on message. Everything kind of went back to his primary message about income inequality. And Hillary Clinton did a great job demonstrating her foreign policy experience and how the depth of her knowledge as far as those issues went, as well as kind of citing experts that agree with her on a variety of different policies. O'Malley, on the other hand, I think I know he says he's running for president, but not vice president. But he seems to agree a little bit with Hillary and a little bit with Bernie. And I don't think he did much to distinguish himself from the other.
He was more aggressive this time, though.
He was. But in most cases, he was agreeing with something with one of the other candidates,
right,
too.
Right. He's more aggressive, trying to punch his way out of those single digit polls, I guess. Alan Schroeder, what did you see here? Kelly Winfrey mentioned the difference between debates at a primary level and in a general election level. That has been true since the first TV debates.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, I mean, it seems to me that there is a greater and greater divergence between the feel of primary debates and the feel of general election debates. This cycle, these debates have become more than ever packaged entertainment. I mean, these enormous ratings that they're drawing, the Iowa debate the other night drew the smallest number of any debate this cycle, but larger than any primary debate in 2012. So you've got this kind of thing that's happening now that the cable news networks have taken over the primary debates of where they're being positioned as moneymakers and ratings grabbers. And so it's, you know, it's kind of a different animal than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, as a journalism professor, too, this can be laid at the feet of Donald Trump. You think all these ratings, because he is unpredictable, entertaining, to say the least.
Yeah, I definitely think that what has happened early on, especially with the first Republican debate, drew a lot of attention. So people were tuning in to see what kind of crazy stuff was going to happen in the debate. And I think also there's some interest because there are some big differences between candidates. But certainly Trump has a part of that. But also the media in general is very good about finding the points of conflict or the sound bites that get people interested in what happened and maybe they watch the next debate.
Mm-hmm. Alan Schroeder, as a professor of journalism at Northeastern University and a presidential debate historian, you have looked back at 50 years of TV debates. Give us a quick sort of flyover over the five decades that you've looked at and how TV debates have evolved. We started our first one in 1960 with that famous one, Kennedy-Nixon.
Absolutely. And there were actually four Kennedy-Nixon debates that year, although only the first one is actually kind of remembered in history. Then another 16 years pass before you have them again. 1976, they resume with Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. And the reason they didn't have them all those years was basically the candidates had been frightened by the Kennedy-Nixon experience. They saw how powerful debates were.
Right. So, I want to play a little bit of audio there to have you comment on it, too. Frightened, people may say, especially those in the younger set may say, frightened? What were they frightened of? Well, here is what they were frightened of, the fallout from this very comment, I think October of 1976. We're in the right up to bumping up to the general election. Gerald Ford there being questioned, and this was the comment he made about, well, the Soviet Union and its relation to Eastern Europe.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
I'm sorry, could I just follow? Did I understand you to say, sir, that the Russians are not using Eastern Europe as their own sphere of influence and occupying most of the countries there and making sure with their troops that it's a communist zone, whereas on our side of the line, the Italians and the French are still flirting with
possibility? I don't believe, Mr. Frankel, that the Yugoslavians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union.
Okay, the moderator even giving Gerald Ford a second chance there, Alan Schroeder, the moderator visibly, if you watch this, flabbergasted that this would come out of a vice president's mouth. Or
yeah,
the president's mouth.
The president's mouth at that point, absolutely. And then compounding the problem for Gerald Ford was it took him a week to set the record straight. I mean, the press just hounded him every single day after that. Don't you mean this? Don't you want to apologize for having misstated the facts? And he wouldn't do it. And so it became this festering sort of story that wouldn't go away until finally, off camera, he apologized and took the words back. But it shows you, you know, the fact that these are spontaneous live moments. So the president probably didn't want to admit that he had, you know, just said something very stupid. And so he dug his heels in. But these things are very powerful in shaping public perception and sometimes not in positive ways for the candidates.
Okay, so after 1976, the scare there to political campaigns anyway, what happened to debates after that? They came back in the 80s?
Yeah, there has been at least one debate in the general election each year since 1976. There was only one in 1980, and every cycle since then there have been at least two, normally three presidentials and one vice presidential. And then in the primary cycle, they're getting actually reduced this year. This year is one of the lowest numbers of debates on both the Democratic and the Republican side that we've seen in about 20 years. And some of that is just the parties coming in and trying to impose some order. You know, candidates don't like to debate, and the parties don't like to have them debate because it's a very risky moment. You're off script. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what your opponent's going to say. You don't know what questions are going to be posed. So if they can minimize that risk by not having as many debates, that's what they'll do, and we certainly see that right now.
Mm-hmm. Kelly Winfrey, and that's exactly what makes it more interesting than the rest of the, I mean, Kelly Winfrey, a journalist covering stump speech, is very predictable. But when we can get a candidate in a situation, well, let's think of an off-the-cuff remark that last election cycle that made news at the Iowa State Fair. Mitt Romney there saying corporations are people, my friend. That was unscripted, and that was one of the quotes that, that defined that last election.
I mean, that's certainly true. And I think a good point that you can get out of looking at the history of debates is that a poor performance or a major gaffe can really hurt a candidate a lot more than really a good performance can help them. They are a liability. But research shows, and I've done some of this research, that debates do help shape public opinion, that they can make people like a candidate more, you know, make them understand their issue positions better. But as Alan mentioned, they are a huge liability because as a campaign manager, communication strategist, you want to keep your candidate on message. And those sort of off-the-cuff statements are where bad things can happen that get replayed over and over and over. I teach a political campaigns class, and that Ford debate segment that you just played is one I always show in that class of debates, and as well as in 1992 when George H.W. Bush looked at his watch during a town hall debate. And it implied that, you know, he had better places to be. And those sort of gaffes or mistakes can really hurt a candidate, right, and the perception of the candidate.
President Obama had a bad debate last time around, too.
Yes.
He seemed impatient and generally
half asleep.
Half asleep, couldn't be bothered being there on stage. He changed his his tact the next debate. But I'm wondering here, Alan, let me put this to you. We have approximately 24 hours before this debate, something that focuses our attention on foreign policy, on national security. So when we look at the people on stage, the three in this case in the Democratic debate, we're looking at them through a different lens. We're saying, who is the commander-in-chief here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And clearly that benefited Hillary Clinton simply because of her stature as having been on the international stage for so many years. I was actually surprised that CBS didn't devote more of that debate. You know, my instinct, I used to be a television producer, my instinct as a producer would be to just throw out everything that they had planned and say, this huge thing happened yesterday, let's talk about it. Let's spend the entire time talking about it. They didn't do that, but obviously there was a great deal of discussion about it within the debate, but in a way that favored one candidate just because of her practical experience.
Mm-hmm. Kelly Winfrey, as someone connected with the Katz Center for Women in Politics, we're seeing Hillary Clinton more or less applauded for her work on Saturday night as acting as a commander-in-chief here. So how does that mesh with being the first woman president?
It's extremely important. The research that I've done and others have done show that women candidates are generally seen as less effective in foreign policy issues and military and security issues. So Hillary Clinton's experience as Secretary of State and her ability to talk about her knowledge in that area goes a very long ways. And I think, you know, as much as income inequality is an important issue and Sanders wants to talk about it and Clinton wants to talk about it as well, the events that happened on Friday and over the weekend make foreign policy a really foregrounded issue in voters' minds. And I think she did a very good job demonstrating what she is like as commander-in-chief and the depth of her ability to analyze and lead in foreign policy issues.
Mm-hmm. And there was actually another moment like that, which is where John Dickerson, the moderator, asked them, what experience has prepared you for the presidency? And Martin O'Malley literally could not come up with an answer. And then Bernie Sanders talked about veterans, which seemed a little off point, especially when Hillary gave her response about, I was in the Situation Room when we got bin Laden. And that just sort of blew everybody else out of the water.
Alan Schroeder, when we talk about the evolution of TV debates, as the author of Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, we had in 2000, approximately, the 1990s, 2000, I don't know where you want to define it, but the internet impacting our debates. How has that changed debates?
Well, it has moved debates from a sort of post-debate evaluation process to a during-the-debate evaluation process. Debates, it used to be you had to wait till the show was over, and then the pundits would come on and tell you sort of their take on it, and you'd read the accounts in the newspaper the next morning. But with Twitter and and Facebook and social media, all these mechanisms for commenting in real time, that ground game, if you will, that ground game of analysis has moved to the debate itself. We saw a great moment in the Iowa debate when the Twitter question was read, basically calling out Hillary Clinton on having kind of ducked behind 9/11 in her response to why does she take so much money from Wall Street. And somebody tweeting, watching the debate, had the question that was read on the air that basically, you know, sort of forced her to take a second crack at it. So I think, you know, as we look at the impact, it really is all about people's instantaneous reactions, and that that becomes part of the program in a way that it never used to be.
I wonder, Kelly, what can you say about public opinion? Are we in debates? I don't know if we can tell who's tuning in. Are these all Democrats on the case of Saturday night? Before that, the Republicans. Are we preaching to the choir, or are we changing minds? Can we say anything about that with debates?
Well, it depends. I for the most part, primary debates are about distinguishing yourself as a candidate among very similar competitors, and also rallying the base. And you see a lot of that both in the Democratic and Republican debates. On Saturday, you heard, you played the clip earlier, the O'Malley clip about Trump being a immigrant bashing carnival barker. and so those sort of things are really about rallying the base and uniting the party in some ways. So for the most part, you are kind of preaching to the choir, but hopefully you're also distinguishing the candidates in some way within that same general philosophy.
Kimberly is with us from Des Moines. Just a few minutes left. Kimberly, what's on your mind as we talk about presidential debates and this past one in particular?
Oh, this one was great. I actually was able to be in the debate hall, so I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I wanted to thank Dr. Winfrey. You were my professor over the summer, and you were amazing. And I'm looking forward to doing some more stuff at the Cat Center. So that being said, one of the things, and you guys just touched on it with the Twitter questions, and we're kind of coming up to the end of February 1st to the caucus. Do you think there are more opportunities, whether they're in large settings, forums, that candidates are going to be able to distinguish themselves a little bit more because we have the lack of debates on the Democratic side?
Who wants to tackle that, Kelly?
Well, we still do have a few debates. And I think what we saw from this one, as you mentioned earlier, kind of the gloves coming off, we're starting to see the three candidates really attack each other on certain issues. And so I think that will be the case. But in general, you know, the debates are the big place to do that. However, you'll see more stump speeches and that sort of thing. And also probably as we get closer, more political advertising that will maybe attack other candidates, but particularly highlight issue positions of the candidates that are still competing.
Alan Schroeder, when there's a series of debates like we've had during this primary season, is it the tendency that there be fewer and fewer viewers as the series continues? Last time we had also so many Republicans, but then the viewership really falls off and accordingly the impact?
Normally, no. In fact, normally it's just the opposite. But, of course, this is not a normal year. Let me give you an example. In 2008, when on the Democratic side you had toward the end there, John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama, and then just ultimately Hillary and Barack doing several debates, those debates were the best watched of the series. And those came, obviously, at the end of the cycle. I think the other thing that's interesting in terms of the viewership this year is that there does seem to be a lot more tune-in for the Republican debates than for the Democratic debates. I'm not sure those are all just Republicans watching the Republican debates, though. I think it is kind of caught on among political folks in general.
Mm-hmm. I'd also add with the Republican debates, I completely agree. I think as the candidate pool shrinks, the viewership might be even higher for those Republican debates because we get so little time for each candidate to speak in those debates. You don't really get much information. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be more content there as the pool shrinks.
Mm-hmm. And also on the GOP side, it's really, you can ask the best political analysts, it's really a toss-up as far as we do not have a front runner. We've had several front runners, Alan, but we do not have a front runner now. It's going to be very interesting going forward.
Absolutely. And you know, I think that's part of the dramatic appeal of these debates is that you know, you really don't know what's going to happen within the program or as a result of the program, you know. And on the Democratic side, it appears to be much more of a foregone conclusion. You know, don't want to jump the gun on that too much, but there isn't that same sort of palpable sense chance of anything can happen here or anyone can emerge victorious. So I think that's another big difference.
We have about a minute left. Kelly Winfrey, what else are you watching in particular in your post at the Katz Center for Women in Politics as this, what we count down 2.5 months or so before the caucuses?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm very interested in Hillary Clinton's strategy and how she handles some of the attacks against her, particularly the Wall Street attacks that Sanders has brought up numerous times. But also, for my personal research interest, is how women voters are responding to her and if she's gaining the support of women voters and how she's doing that and why. And mm-hmm. which women?
Mm-hmm. What can you say about the answers to those questions briefly?
Well, it'll depend. We know polling-wise she does very well with minority women, and she's doing better with white women. Her biggest struggle is with white married women. And so we'll have to do some post-election analysis of why that is.
Okay. Kelly Winfrey, thank you very much. Assistant professor at Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism, coordinator of research and outreach at the Katz Center for Women and Politics at ISU. Kelly, thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Schroeder, before we say goodbye, what are you looking forward to as a historian?
Well, this year has been so crazy and offbeat that I'm not sure yet where we're going with this. So
okay.
I'm going to withhold judgment until I see how the story turns out.
Very good. Thank you for joining us. Yeah. Alan Schroeder, professor of journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had help in Ames from Sean McLean in Des Moines, from John Pemble. And tomorrow on this program, we'll have the University of Northern Iowa President William Rood. That coming up, also an interview with Carly Fiorina. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.